The low lights and the projector overhead make me feel like we're in the movies. Somebody should set a popcorn concession in the back. Two announcements. One, it occurred to me the other day after I made the announcement regarding the voluntariness of your attendance at the discussion section Friday afternoon at 1:30, that you may have inferred from that, mistakenly, that the reading of the reading assignment was also voluntary. Now, that is not the case. The reading assignment still stands. What's up to you entirely is whether or not you'd like to come in and talk about it Friday afternoon at 1:30. The other announcement is this, that Mr. Otting has just now graciously condescended to give me 2 additional days to lecture to you. Here I thought he was doing me a favor until you left. Now I begin to have second thoughts. And those additional 2 days on the Lutheran Reformation will come not next week, but the week following, on Monday and Tuesday, a week from next Monday and Tuesday. All right. To continue. We were on subpart number 5, Struggles in the Monastery and the Tower Experience. And we were asking ourselves, what, as far as the clear historical evidence goes, are some of the contributing factors to Luther's so-called Anfechtungen on the negative side? And we had pointed out that the monastic way certainly had something to contribute to this experience, not by way of final explanation, to be sure. The evidence seems pretty clear that this at least gave color and structure to Luther's Tentationes. The whole promise which the monastic way held out to the candidate for a way to perfection, and you recall how it was that we defined this kind of perfection. It was not a literal, simple moral perfection, as though the monk, if he tried hard enough, might yet succeed this side of the grave in becoming sinless. No, indeed. But there was, in the monastic discipline, at least some optimism, some hope held out that he could eradicate a measure of sin in the course of his personal progress and piety, and that for the rest, there would be, through the, of course, increasing sense of his guilt, for this is bound to emerge as a man becomes more and more sensitive to what his sins really are, there would always be, of course, the Church's resources for consolation and forgiveness in the sacrament of penance, in the Eucharist, in the confessional, and so on. Now, we said, following through on this, that the particular twist that this seemed to have given, this monastic way seemed to have given to Luther's own Anfechtungen, was that the monastic way seemed to have the very opposite effect for him. It wasn't a question, as he himself often said, that he was always aware of all the great things which he ought to have done, but which he still did not succeed in doing. That wasn't nearly the extent of the assault, of the struggle, of the conflict that he went through. But the very dynamic of the monastic life, of which he felt very much a part, namely the very striving to become right with God, so that a man might find value, coram Deo, off of which he might live with assurance and freedom, that very striving itself, so it seemed to Luther more and more clearly, was the very root, the very radix, like radish, the very radical basis of a man's sin. And this is the thing which he continued to refer to more and more increasingly as the opinio justitiae, the illusion of righteousness, we might translate this, which is basic to every human heart. It doesn't only mean that every man assumes that he is righteous. That isn't what Luther meant by the opinio justitiae. But the inbred lust or concupiscence or drive in a man to seek his value in his own biographical existence. And somehow, if he's going to amount to anything, if he's going to count for anything in any ultimate sense of the word, namely before God, then that value will have to be produced within his own life history and his own moral and religious experience. This is so basic because it is so ineradicable. And the worst of it is that the better a man gets as a human being, the more subtle does this very opinio justitiae become. So, the monastic way did, at least in an incidental way, give a kind of structure to his Anfechtungen. A second clear evidence, by way of a negative factor in his Anfechtungen, was the influence of the very nominalist theology we've spoken about before. I repeat, I am not suggesting this as an ultimate explanation of his Anfechtungen, but as a contributing factor which gave form to the Tentationes. One of the things in nominalist theology, which we deliberately skirted the other day, was that along with the high sense which nominalist theology had about the freedom of God, it tried, perhaps vainly, but it tried to counterbalance this emphasis upon the majestic and free will of God with a like emphasis upon the freedom of the man who is related to God. And the assurance was held out to this man that if he would strive, that is, if he would do what in him lay, facere quod in se est, to do what naturally is available to you to do, with the resources, the God-given resources that are available to him, in his native state as a human being, he might succeed to a measure of righteousness within himself, which could then turn God's judgment, which previously was against him, in his favor. And so the accent on human freedom was meant to be a positive source of consolation to the sinner who felt oppressed by the overarching judgment of God. And yet this very accent upon human freedom not only left Luther cold, so that he felt, alas, he didn't have this freedom. The point was that if he really did, if there was this freedom, then why was it that at every turn he was employing this freedom against himself and indeed against God? Now again, not employing the freedom against God simply in the form of crass and external sins, but with the very secret of his being. Here is a God who presumably loves him, so it is said, and who wants him to believe that God loves him. And yet, why is it that a man in the face of such an announcement nevertheless strives to be worthy of that love, if by no other means than by saying that he's unworthy and hoping that that will make him worthy of God? And so the nominalist accent on human freedom, in a kind of left-handed way, shaped the structure of Luther's Anfechtungen and all the more. And a third contributing factor, these are chosen almost at random, a third contributing factor for which there's strong historical evidence that it did tend to shape the structure of Luther's Anfechtungen, is the influence of Augustinian theology particularly now the Augustinian accent on divine predestination. The Augustine whom Luther knew and operated with in these early years was an Augustine who made large room, to be sure, for the gracious predestination by God of the faithful. But it was the same God who also permitted some to stay outside the scope of this grace and allowed them to be abandoned to their own sinful fates. Of course, you can guess what this meant for a monk oppressed as he was, like Martin Luther. And so the ultimate question of his despair, and it's indicated, at least it's hinted in the question, how can I find a gracious God, was not simply the question, what must I do to find a gracious God, but is there a gracious God at all for me? The frustrations, I suppose, folks like you and I feel, not only in trying to describe this sort of situation in the life of another Christian like Martin Luther, describe it to the modern man, is that you immediately sense in your audience or in the man to whom you're telling it that he doesn't understand what you're talking about at all, because it's an experience which is utterly remote from his own life, or B, that if he does even remotely understand what it is you're representing to him in this description of a man like Luther, he immediately has a ready explanation for it, and the explanation is not usually a theological one, but more often than not a medical one. Now, medical explanations of Luther abound, and some of them are not short of brilliant. I refer you to the one by Erickson, Young Man Luther, which came out several years ago. A very astute neo-Freudian psychoanalytic understanding of Luther. And it was this book, by the way, which provided almost all the ammunition for Osborne as he wrote his play, Luther, some of which, as he took it over and magnified it, to the embarrassment of Erickson, by the way, as Osborne magnified some of this material, became better and better theater, but less and less historically accurate. I think, for example, I mentioned this, discussed this with one of you yesterday who had seen the play over Christmas, the reference, the strong, prominent, central reference in the play to Luther's epilepsy, for which there's really no historical ground. But it did make good theater. Well, without going into the details of some of the psychiatric studies of Luther, suffice it to be said that the external factors which were present in his life were present in the lives of many, many people at his time who didn't react the way he did. They were exposed to the same kind of monastic discipline, to the same kind of Augustinian theology, to the same kind of nominalist theology, and yet did not read into these situations what Luther did. And yet once he did read into them what he did read into them, it's possible for us to see, well, by George, those factors are there. It is not a distortion, in other words, not necessarily a distortion of the monastic way of life or of nominalist theology or of Augustinian doctrine of predestination, to see in these contexts what Luther does indeed see in them. And so it would still leave the theological question to go begging. Suppose that there were psychological factors which precipitated the Anfechtungen that Luther experienced. The question might still stand, is what Luther sees about God and his relationship to the sinner true? Might well be that a man is a manic depressive, let's say. And in his manic states or in his depressive states, he might come to the recognition that there is a God indeed, but this God is wrathful. You're not going to say, certainly, William James had a name for this fallacy, he called it the genetic fallacy. You're not going to say that because the man is emotionally ill, that therefore what he says is untrue. For that doesn't follow. Indeed, it may be that just because he has gone through the psychological anguish that he has an exceptional access to things theological that people who are not emotionally disturbed do not have access to. At least it leaves the psychiatric question ambiguous and in abeyance. And of course, if you wanted to start on Martin Luther, no telling where you would stop. I've often wondered whether Saul of Tarsus would make it into seminary or college today if, along with the entrance examinations, you would have to take certain psychological tests, and let's say in the course of the interview with the campus psychologist, who would say, "Have you ever had any unusual experiences?" And he would say, "Well, yes, one day on the way to Damascus." And I can well imagine that if this were a church-related or a private school, the university psychologist might well say to him, "I bet you would enjoy going to school at a state school, a tax-supported university." Well, so be it. But one other passing comment on the many psychiatric studies that have been done on Luther, and some of them, by the way, have been highly appreciative of Luther. Erickson is a case in point. One of the things which is always a source of bafflement to a good many of the really reputable psychiatric studies of Luther is the fact that if by the canons of the mental hygiene movement today, Luther could be classified, let us say, as neurotic, then how do you account for the obvious fact, which is almost never found, people who have this kind of illness, a tremendous capacity for productivity, for work? And by the way, I guess if you need any kind of documentation for that, all you've got to do is to go over into our library and look at that section in the stacks, which includes the Weimarische Ausgabe, Luther's collected works, and you would think that for most of us it would take about 7 or 8 lifetimes to produce that much. And all of this production, by the way, without the help of indoor plumbing, which is a noteworthy thing to remember. Just think how this would curtail your production today. You think I'm joking, I'm not. And let me add, all without the help, let's say, of aspirin. How far would a 20th century theologian get today producing that fulsomely without the help of contact or Emprin, you know? And being a sick man physically on top of it all the way through. Well, I'm not here to defend him. I'd just like to obtrude some contrary considerations, though, in the face of the temptation of the modern mind to simply explain away the unfectum or the tentationes on psychotherapeutic grounds. Now, so much for what might have been some of the negative contributing factors to the breakdown aspect of Luther's tentationes. Let's turn the whole picture around now and ask, how might we account for the recovery element, which is also always a feature in these unfectums? And may I insert here, men, as a reminder, lest this hasn't been clear, that if this looks like the preoccupation with the private life of one individual, then it wouldn't be worth the time we're spending on it. And that usually isn't the reason that the Luther researchers do spend so much time on Luther's unsexing him. The point, rather, is that here you have as gutsy, I suppose, as down-to-earth, as slice-of-life sort of picture as one can possibly get of the man's theology. It was always, as he constantly reiterated, it was a theology of experience, of life. It was not simply something for ink on paper, but it was never removed from the actual day-to-day experience of the living Christian. So it's a kind of spotlight on all that the man had to say in public and in print. All right, now we've turned the question around and we've asked what might be some of the positive contributing factors on the recovery side. I'm tempted to say they're the resurrection side of this mortification. Now, rather than think of these factors, and I'm going to mention six of them, rather than think of them as explanations, I'd like to recur here to the language of chemistry and think of these factors as catalytic agents. They contributed something. They seemed to trigger. There was something in his environment which helped to trigger his recovery from the tentaciones. But this does not pretend that they were the actual chemical elements in the recovery. Let's put it another way. What might have been some of the catalytic factors in Luther's life and in his environment which helped him to the discovery of the gospel? And that's putting it less in personal and more in theological terms. Well, okay, again, number one, the monastic way of life wasn't without its resources for consolatio, for assurance. Even if it was only this, namely, Luther refers to this occasionally later on, even if it was only this, that there was some older brother in the monastery, who it was, we don't know, who could approach the young monk and who could say, I command you to believe in the forgiveness of sins. Now, it wasn't the fact that it was a command, for that seems so unlike the gospel, but that the older brother could make the command to believe in the forgiveness of sins did indeed presuppose that the forgiveness of sins really was a reality. And this is what Luther admired, at least in those who could trust the forgiveness of sins. The monasteries had a whole tradition, a very long and hoary tradition by this time, of how to deal with the so-called scrupulant, the man who was afflicted with scrupulosity. But scrupulosity usually meant the sort of character who, the minute he got up from the confessional booth and walked away, was tempted to come right back because it suddenly occurred to him that there was that particular sin which he had forgotten to confess. Now, this is usually what is thought about as scrupulosity, even in casuistry, in moral theology in the Roman Church today. And there were elaborate manuals for dealing with the scrupulant in the monastery. Jean Gerson, for example, had written a manual on the scrupulant. But this aspect of the monastic life did not help Luther. For, as he himself frequently said, looking back from later years, that the trouble with him in his desperatio, his despair, was not so much, it was not only that he despaired of himself, but that he despaired of God. And the manuals on scrupulosity had nothing to say about that. For what if it really is so? that there is a God who saves so few and damns so many. Yes, what is? Number two, a second positive contributing factor, a catalytic agent from the outside, let's say, which assisted him to the discovery of the gospel, however minimally, seemed to have been his association with his superior in the order, Dr. Staupitz. And Luther, to the end of his life, never forgot this debt that he owed Staupitz. And usually when he describes the help which Staupitz gave him, the description comes out to be about the same thing every time over. Staupitz emphasized to him that any theology which magnifies the benefits of Christ and consoles sore and afflicted consciences is by that token a good theology. Now, perhaps you noticed the phrase as I recited it to you. If this was Staupitz's own wording, it's interesting to see how that very wording, almost verbatim, made its way from Staupitz through Luther to Melanchthon into the very confessions which are the symbols of our church, notably the Augustana and the Apology. Or Staupitz would admonish the young monk to hide himself in the wounds of Jesus Christ. And I suppose it's a kind of ecclesiastical irony that Staupitz, who maintained his fondness and his affection for Luther to the day he died, did himself not see fit to follow Luther in his Reformation movement, but himself died in, as a superior in a Benedictine monastery. Well, let's stop at this point and take stock of how far we've gone so far. We haven't yet said, at least we haven't yet gotten to the nub of that secret of the Reformation, as we've called it, to that discovery of what the gospel really is, at least not the way you have found it described in your Luther readings, for example, in the Galatians commentary or in the 1545 preface to his Latin works. There you recall in the second one of those works, Luther, looking back upon his life, had said that the real breakthrough came when he discovered the evangelical meaning of Justitia Dei, of the righteousness of God. Now, in these very years on which I'm presently dwelling, you do indeed find Luther talking about the Justitia Dei. And you do indeed find him talking about Jesus Christ as central to the Christian gospel. But, and this is my point, it isn't enough to say that Luther discovered the gospel when he discovered Jesus Christ. Or it isn't enough to say that Luther discovered the gospel when he discovered the formula, the righteousness of God. For both of these features were prominent in scholastic theology, and both of these features were prominent in the theology of the pre-Reformation Luther. What you would immediately have to add, however, is what was it that he discovered about Jesus Christ? Not that Jesus Christ suddenly loomed prominently into his theology. He was prominent in his theology all along. Not just that the accent on the righteousness of God suddenly loomed prominently in his theology. It loomed prominently all along. But what was it about Jesus Christ? And what was it about the righteousness of God which accounted for the great turnabout which made for the Reformation? And this you don't yet find at this early stage, at least not very clearly, not unambiguously, in Luther's theology. The sort of thing that you find Staupitz saying to him does foreshadow. It does indeed foreshadow some of the things that Luther later on came to see with full clarity about Christ and about the righteousness of God. Well, a third catalytic agent in Luther's discovery of the gospel, and this follows quite naturally from our reference to Staupitz. I'd mentioned to you yesterday that Staupitz, who very likely was not much of a nominalist, but much more a Thomist, also revealed a strong influence from the quarter of German mysticism. And on this score, too, Luther continued, though decreasingly, continued to acknowledge his debt to German mysticism in helping him, too, the breakthrough to the Christian gospel. In fact, he was so impressed with one of the standard works of German mysticism, Deutsche Theologie, Theologia Germania, that he himself undertook to have the work published in abridged form in 1516 and then in 1518 in its full unabridged version. He read the sermons of Tauler assiduously, and at one point speaks of Tauler as the greatest theologian Germany had ever produced. But it wasn't everything about German mysticism that seemed to be of service to him. In fact, if you and I were to read the Deutsche Theologie today and then put it down and pick up Luther's theology, you would wonder what he found in common with it. You would wonder whether he wasn't overzealous in his praise of it, whether he wasn't in some measure hoodwinked by it. For one of the things that would strike you and me today almost immediately about German mysticism was its tendency toward pantheism. And you don't find this in Luther. Now that's a discussion by itself, but let's omit that. What was it about German mysticism which became very prominent in Luther's early theological thinking? Well, it was particularly this. The religious man is the man who becomes aware that it is nothing that we do, feel, think, or say which renders us valuable before God or puts us into communion with God. On the contrary, all that we think, do, or say, all the very content of our lives, the very content of our consciousness, our deeds and our misdeeds, our thoughts and our misthoughts, our good feelings and our bad feelings, all of this has to be reduced to absolutely zero. The complete annihilation of the self before God is what is important. And this is expressed in the desperatio sui, the complete despair of oneself, so that there is nothing about myself which any longer preoccupies me in the presence of God. And thereby I am emptied of all that is I. So the house has been cleaned and opened entirely for the invasion from the divine. And the converse side of this desperatio sui in German mysticism, where the self is virtually annihilated as it stands before God, is that right on the other side of this despair of self stands God with his graciousness. A man is closest to God's mercy when he is most desperate about himself. When I am weak, then am I strong. You see the abiding influence, for example, of this tack in German mysticism in Luther's, even his mature theology, For example, perhaps you noticed in the 1531 Galatians lectures, which you read last week, that on occasion, when he exegizes the Psalms, the psalmist is really only speaking in the person of Jesus Christ. It is Christ who says, though through the words of the psalmist, out of the depths have I cried unto thee, O Lord, Lord, hear my voice. It is Christ who says, in the words of the psalmist, my bones wax old through my roaring all the day long. My moisture is turned into the drought of summer. I water my couch with my tears, as you said this morning in the psalm. Now, this so-called tropological interpretation of the psalm, as you find Luther doing it even in his later years, owes a great debt to German mysticism, with respect particularly to that one feature which I just mentioned, namely that as the man is driven to the depths, he is there closest indeed to God's love. And how was it that Christ bore our sin by himself being driven to the depths, culminating finally in the cry of dereliction, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And as the Christian sinner now follows Christ in the imitation of his suffering and participating in this annihilation of self, being driven to the depths of despair, there at that moment he is close and closest of all to the mercy of the Heavenly Father. So German mysticism, at least as a kind of external catalytic, gave a kind of shape to the recovery side of the Tentationes. Now a fourth factor, Augustinianism. The fifth one is going to be nominalism, and I better tell you that now, because what I have to say under number four is really intertwined with, it's interwoven with, the influence of nominalism upon Luther's discovery of the gospel. There's a very striking characteristic in Occamist theology about the way in which it conceived the meaning of sin. Sin in nominalist theology is not primarily the sin which we do. Sin is not defined primarily in terms of our behavior. It is that only secondarily. The determinative characteristic about a sinner's sin is that God adjudges it to be sin. And considered by itself, this is a very high biblical accent. It would mean, for example, that in an atheistic universe, if there were no God, but even though men continued to be what they are, then it would follow that there would be no sin. People might still hate, cheat, lie, be loveless, and all the rest, but that isn't enough to make all this sinful. It is sinful finally only if God concurs in the judgment and says, I despise that, I reject it, and so on, adjudges it as sinful. So there's this transcendent element in Occamist theology and its whole understanding of sin, that a sinner is a sinner because God adjudges him to be one. I thought I had said that I was going to talk about Augustinianism. Well, okay, I am. What I said about the nominalist view of the transcendent character of sin only sets us up now to show what kind of further contribution the Augustinianism added to Luther's concept of sin. Augustine also, of course, thought of sin in terms of the transcendent judgment of God, but sin is not that primarily. For Augustine, sin is primarily a grievous injury, a vitium, a poisoning, a perversion right within the life of the sinner himself. It is the profound fault in the humanum, in the humanity of a man. A profound corruption of his human nature, and right imminently within his human nature. And this is one of the things that Luther took from Augustinianism and added it to the transcendent character of sin in nominalist theology. Sin is both simultaneously. It is a tremendous perversion of man as he was ideally created by God, and it is at the same time God's concurring negative wrathful judgment against him. Now, the minute you add this Augustinian immanence to man's sin, you play hob with the next step in Occam's theology. Because you'll recall I said that in the theology of the nominalists, even though sin may have been God's negative judgment against the man, still that man had within himself a measure of positive freedom to redeem his lot before God, to do what in him lay, facere quod in se est. And if he made at least the modest efforts that were required to transform himself, then it could be expected, that is, according to nominalist theology, that the judgment of God would turn from negative to positive in his favor. But now, if you add to this definition of sin that man is so profoundly corrupted, so vitiated by this deep-seated flaw, which is as deep-seated as his own nature is, then this belies the nominalist accent on doing what in you lies, for that door no longer stands open for you. And so you might say that Luther Augustinianized his Occamist conception of sin, that this only made all human efforts at self-justification the more impossible. Now, on the other side, and we're still under number four, on the other side, Luther retained the Occamist accent on the transcendent character of God's judgment when he moved into the area of God's grace. For here, what renders a man righteous is not primarily an inner transformation of his own sinful life. But what renders a man righteous on the gospel side is that God, in his overarching, his transcendent evaluation of man, declares a man to be righteous, to be pleasing to him, to be a delight to his fatherly heart. He is righteous essentially because God says he is. God chooses to regard him as such. And here you might say, perhaps at the risk of stretching a point, that on the abiding insistence in Luther's theology upon what it is that makes a man righteous before God, namely that God in his grace reckons him righteous, you still see the echo of the old Occamist accent on a man's being made to be what he is by virtue of what God regards him to be. Now, how about Augustinianism on this point? Augustine also said, of course, that God's graciousness is omnipotent. And a man is righteous because God reckons him as such, but that isn't the end of the matter for Augustine. With God's gracious predestination comes this miraculous, wondrous transformation of the man himself, which Augustine could extol in such moving phrases. But this element, this emphasis in Augustine, Luther somehow missed, or perhaps he deliberately missed it. And you can't help but speculate, if Luther had taken that side of Augustine awfully seriously, that in order to be justified before God, a man must be righteously transformed within his own person, then one is tempted to think that Augustine would only have heightened, rather than lessened, Luther's grounds for despair. But what he does see in Augustine on the gospel side is the omnipotence of God's grace. God's grace is so all-powerful that it can overcome, it can trump, it can negate his negative judgment against the sinner. And then Luther seems to soft-pedal the immanent factor in Augustine's theology that the righteous judgment of God must issue if it is going to be valid in a righteous transformation of the believer himself, so that finally his righteousness will consist in his own new capacity to love God. Well, this does not shine through so prominently in Luther. Not on the doctrine of justification, it doesn't. And so we might say that if Luther Augustinianized his Occamist conception of sin, on the other hand, he sort of Occamized, nominalized, his Augustinian conception of God's grace. That the believer's righteousness before God stands with God's judgment of him as righteous. It does not stand or fall with his own righteous transformation of his life. All right, now fifthly. We've already said a lot about Occamism. Let's add one point. The fifth is our concern to say that Occamism, too, in other ways than we have already mentioned, provided a kind of catalyst for Luther's discovery of the gospel. And here the feature of nominalism that I have in mind is the nominalist accent upon Scripture. God's special revelation of himself through the Holy Scriptures versus the impossibility of knowing God by means of ratio, reason. And having said this now, we've set ourselves up for number six. And I really don't know whether I should include this in a list with the preceding five, because it almost seems to be different in kind from those preceding five catalysts. Maybe this isn't just a catalytic factor. Well, what is it? It's the actual immersion of himself in the Scriptures, which seems to have done more for precipitating Luther's discovery of the gospel than any of the preceding five factors may have. It's a real question among the Luther researchers just when Luther experienced the so-called tower experience, just when and where, or at least just when it was that he made his breakthrough to the gospel. And partly that's a problem because he gives us two different conflicting accounts. But both of his accounts place the time of his discovery of the gospel in the period when he was lecturing on the books of Scripture at the University of Wittenberg, and he directly connects his discovery of the gospel with discoveries which he made in the scriptures themselves. Well, I guess we'll have to postpone the continuation until a week from next Monday.